More Broken God SCPs. The Church of the Broken God is one of the oldest staples of the SCP universe, an organization that worships cold metal and warm circuits, with the belief that their deity, Mechane, was shattered long ago and needs only to be reforged. While they started as a very enigmatic, but pretty obviously fanatically villainous group, the introduction of their counterpart in sarcasm has led them to sit generally in the enemy of my enemy is my friend category. I've looked at quite a lot of Broken God SCPs over the years, but generally they're either a small part of a larger work, or they themselves are larger works. We're going to be checking out a handful of smaller articles dedicated to the Broken God's various cults. Let's take a look. Let's start with SCP-3882, which currently refers to five concept albums created by the Shattered Deus, a three-person metal group affiliated with Mechanism. The aim of the group, in the words of founding member 16 Edgar Kingsmith .5, is spreading the word of Mechane and rocking the F out while doing so. Each album corresponds to a major piece of Mechanite scripture, and while all fitting in the genre of metal music, each instance varies in tone and composition. All instances share the same basic anomaly, where a mimetic agent is inserted into the instrumentation of the songs. When made audible, it causes the implantation of knowledge of relevant pieces of Mechanite scripture into the listeners, which varies from album to album. The first album is titled Rise and Fall of Mechane, with 12 tracks. The songs are an amalgamated retelling of various Mechanite creation myths from the Book of Shattering. The music generally conforms to the glam metal genre, but the final two tracks are more akin to industrial metal. The second album is titled Brass Rites and Silicon Rituals, with 17 tracks. Each track retells a different ceremony or ritual as described in both Maxwellist and Cogwork Orthodox teachings. Broken Church teachings are notably absent. The third album is Horrors of the Flesh, a death metal album with 22 tracks. This album is a retelling of the books of Horrors and Disassembly, which both portend various apocalyptic events relevant to the teachings of Mechanism. The fourth album is titled Defragment One, largely focusing on Maxwellist gospels, particularly the accounts of saints. Most of the tracks have techno instrumentation, but have lyrics in the style of metal songs. The last album is titled Steam-Powered Souls, the songs of which retell pieces of Cogwork Orthodox scripture related to the augmentation of members through anomalous means. This one is significantly more somber than other albums, and members of the band cite the song Hurt by Nine Inch Nails as a major inspiration for the album. Knowledge implanted by the anomaly is accompanied by a minor compulsive effect in individuals that are not members of any Mechanite sect. They will be passively drawn to individuals, objects, writings, and iconography relevant to the Mechanite faiths. In several cases, affected individuals were capable of locating a single member of the Church of Maxwellism in a crowd of over 200 non-anomalous individuals. This behavior typically leads to the discovery of Mechanism, but due to the large amount of both anomalous and mundane body modification undergone by most major sects, conversion rate is predictably low. Due to being a method through which the general populace can discover relatively benign anomalies, SCP-3882 is part of the Triumvirate's Project Ennui, mainly focusing on distribution of 3882 in North America, the UK, and Japan. This is a good time to mention that 3882 is related to SCP-2217, which outlined a coming war between the Mechanites and SCP-610, the Flesh That Hates, which is of course now connected to sarcasm. The Triumvirate, a joint task force between the Foundation, the Horizon Initiative, and the Global Occult Coalition, created Project Ennui to gradually introduce certain anomalies to the public to prepare them for the coming war. We're then given some info on the members of the band, starting with 16 Edgar Kingsmith .5, who belongs to the Broken Church sect. He converted to mechanism following two tours in the Iraq War and subsequent loss of his left leg. He was approached by the mechanist charity God's Arms, which offered a replacement limb in exchange for him studying mechanist teachings. He received an anomalous artificial organ made of clockwork replacing his larynx as a display of loyalty sometime later, and he fought in several conflicts between proto-triumvirate forces and the Broken Church, including a retaliatory assault for a Horizon Initiative attack on a Broken Church settlement. His leg is an Anderson Robotics model, which acts as a speaker with high audio fidelity, and his fingers on both hands have been replaced with custom-made augmentations that are capable of producing sound when strumming the air. On bass guitar is Great Engine 94, a member of the Cogwork Orthodoxy sect. Their date of birth and name is unknown, but they are allegedly a lifelong member of the Cogwork Orthodoxy. They underwent full-body conversion at the age of 21, and their only biological components remaining are the skeletal structure, heart, and larynx. They joined the group after seeing Kingsmith .5 performing solo in Backdoor Soho in New York. A collapsible bass guitar is integrated into their torso, which is removable without threatening the integrity of the body. They have vocal amplifiers located above their larynx, allowing for up to 130 decibels of vocal amplification without physical strain, and low-power ballistic cannons located in their shoulders, allowing for the detonation of fireworks or blanks, capable of producing sounds of up to 140 decibels. Lastly, on drums and backup vocals, is Jackintosh of Albany, a member of the Church of Maxwellism. She was born in London, a second-generation Maxwellist, and originally saw a performance by the Shattered Dais in Three Portlands, convincing the other two to include her in the band after a musical battle in hastily made Cleveland Backdoor in Cleveland, Ohio. She has speakers implanted in her shoulders, her eardrums are connected to an implanted 3-terabyte hard drive, allowing for the recording of several hundred hours of music, and has holographic projectors located around her solar plexus, which allow for the production of semi-solid light constructs, which act as drums. We're then given lyrics for a handful of songs from their albums, but I'll just read out one of them. From The Gears of the Universe, off of their fifth album. Turning eternal, the stars are cogs. Atoms grind in time to the music of the spheres. Energies fold upon themselves as a background radiation battle rages for a billion years. We feel the warmth of the eternal engines, shielding us from the cold chaos. Factory fires, widening gyres, entropy consumes us. Still, the gears of the universe turn. In June of 2019, Dr. Yi Soon met with all three members of the Shattered Dais in Albany, New York, in order to negotiate a release of their albums to the general public. Kingsmith .5 remarks that this is weird, as they've tried to exterminate their religion for the past 100 years or so, and now suddenly they want to spread it. Dr. Soon understands their apprehension, but they've become a valuable ally in light of what happened at Baikal. They've engineered a cure for the flesh virus, they're beating back the Sarkics better than ever, but the world's going to end in one way or another. Humanity isn't prepared for a god of flesh and a god of metal duking it out. He asks them where that's going to happen, and Jackintosh says that there's a lot of debate over where the great battle is going to take place. Supposedly, it's at the easternmost point of the world, but that was back when they thought the world was flat, like the surface of an anvil. The consensus among the tickers is Korea, while the headcanon in the network is that it's going to be somewhere in Siberia. Dr. Soon says that in any case, they need some osmosis to prepare people for what's coming. They're already employing some paratech not found outside of Three Ports in medical procedures among the general populace. The Cleveland Clinic has figured out how to grow and transplant new stomachs with the schematics they gave them from Prometheus Labs. They're also releasing some anomalous media. Basically, if it doesn't kill anyone, they're releasing it, and their music seems like a good place to start the osmosis of mechanism into the popular consciousness. The three individuals then deploy antenna from their skulls and stay still for approximately 50 seconds before Jackintosh says that it took a bit to convince Great Engine, but they're happy to have a wider audience. She asks what the release schedule is, and Dr. Soon says that they're thinking of combining Rise and Fall and Brass Rites into a single album and releasing it under their music label. Jackintosh asks if they'd get some of the profits at least, and Dr. Soon says of course, as they're not Motown. They'd also give it enough exposure that it became semi-mainstream. Great Engine 94 tells him to not let it start a juggalo movement. Kingsmith .5 also says to not have any zealots born of this either. They have some original recordings, they can probably tone down the parts of Her Word they have in there. Jackintosh remarks that they're about to record a single from their sixth album, too. It's going to be epic. The first single is called Voltaic Virtues, Electro Metal, mainly focusing on a lesser-known faction of the Maxwellists, the Tesla Society. They're really gaining traction, especially in those who grew up in mixed religion households. Dr. Soon finishes the conversation by asking why they don't produce more industrial metal, to which Kingsmith .5 just says that that's a bit stereotypical. It is somewhat amusing that in this timeline, the Foundation is interested in engaging in a cultural war with the public to teach them about the importance of Mechane and the Broken God in the coming war. I assume there's some steep competition from the Sarkic band, The Flesh That Rocks. Moving on, we have SCP-3221, a Class 3 interdimensional aperture located in an underground complex in the Gorno-Badakhshan region of Tajikistan. Direct access to the anomaly is prevented by an extensive array of clockwork-based para-technology, supplemented by a large number of hemomantic seals and wards. When partially activated, an event known as a window event, 3221 serves as a visual window into another dimension. Attempting to look into the aperture during a window event will allow the viewer to see an apparently random part of this dimension. A full activation, known as a shatter event, allows passage between the prime dimension and the alternate dimension. Window events appear to occur randomly, while shatter events appear to be deliberately caused by 3221-2, an Olympia-class humanoid anomaly originally dating from the 5th century CE. It possesses reality-altering abilities of unknown strength, and has undergone extensive bodily alterations resembling that of a Sarkic Karsist. In addition, large portions of its anatomy have been replaced with Mechanite para-technology. References to 3221 have been extant in literature since 1109 CE, and all such references identify the alternate dimension with the kingdom of Prester John, a mythical medieval kingdom of Nestorian Christians. Later historical analysis conducted following the anomaly's discovery in 1997 identified the 5th century Hephthalite Empire as a nation originally ruled by 3221-2. Inhabitants of the alternate dimension are adherents of a syncretic religion composed of Sarkicism, broken god worship, and Gnostic Christianity. This faith is a highly idiosyncratic worship of the humanoid anomaly as a messianic figure of a dualistic godhead consisting of a manifestation of flesh and a manifestation of steel. Theophagy, the ritualistic consumption of a deity, is emphasized as a means of apotheosis, and worshippers believe that 3221-2 will eventually consume both halves of the duality in order to ascend as God. The humanoid anomaly is believed to have been originally expelled to the dimension following a joint action of Mechanite and proto-Sarkic cults in the 5th century AD. The only known shatter event occurred sometime in the 12th century, following which a further alliance of Sarkics, Mechanites, and a precursor to ORIA recontained the subject after decades of warfare. We're provided a short table of various anomalies viewed through the window during window events. One was a large green field in which a tall fountain could be observed. Two elderly men stood directly before it, facing the entrance to 3221. Another was a large stone cavern, with a green substance seeming to be pouring from the roof. Several precious stones could be seen to float in its surface. Another had the humanoid anomaly standing alone before an army of unknown origin. The soldiers attempt to attack the entity using pike and shot tactics common to 17th century Europe. All musket fire returned upon their own formations, and cross-shaped spires of bone rise among the ranks as the vision ends. Another showed a river flowing through a desert, apparently composed of milk. Several pieces of honeycomb, as well as a large variety of precious stones, can be seen floating on the surface. Another showed a large series of sand dunes, which appeared to move and shift as if they were water. Several fish could be seen to be thrown out of the sand dunes before falling and being reabsorbed by the sand. Another vision showed a large banqueting hall, appropriate for mid-13th century Europe. A large variety of guests appeared to be eating human limbs from golden plates. The last one showed a figure dressed in priest's robes, giving a sermon welcoming 10 initiates into their faith. The initiates proceed to group into pairs, following which they ritualistically consume the flesh of their partner's left forearm. The left arms of all assembled are then amputated and replaced with clockwork limbs similar to those possessed by many broken god worshippers. There are two messages inscribed on either side of the entrance to the chamber containing 3221. One is written in medieval Latin, while the other is written in a Neo-Adatite script. The Latin one reads, "Sealed here is Ioannis the Unbroken, betrayer of us all, heretic consumer of a fragment of her heart, a son of the true God corrupted by her opposite. Twice we failed to destroy him. Twice we could only foist his corruption upon another world. May a third chance never arrive. Should we falter in our vigil, then you, our successor, must rise in our place. Use the visions. They are our greatest feat, and the keys to your victory." The one in Neo-Adatite just reads, "Abomination, slave, danger, shame." On August 18, 2010, a small church in Kyrgyzstan associated with the Church of the East was found to be performing an unusual prayer as part of its liturgy. Translated, it reads, "In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, hallowed be the name of the Father, who answers the common prayers of the many who congregate together. We pray for the coming of your new world, and for the coming of your kingdom, and that of the Oriental Monarch, of the Holy Prester John, who dwells in the life everlasting, his mind at last free, and no longer warped through a succession of sincerities, no longer subject to his hunger. We pray for our king and for his endless feast, and for his armies, for the children of his land that continue to be given to the cross, until our world can be bathed in the holy light of their righteous swords. In the name of the flesh, and of the steel, and of the holy corpse, world without end." So basically, some guy a long time ago ate a part of the broken god's heart, SCP-882, and also got into a little sarkic flesh crafting with the goal of becoming a combined deity. Apparently, this pissed off both the Mechanites and the Sarkics, so they kicked him out of this reality. It seems he's finding a way to come back in, though. While it's true that the Mechanites and the Sarkics really don't like each other, it seems that they like someone that mixes the religions even less. I suppose that's not too surprising. Next, we have SCP-2307, the remains of a longsword with a 56-centimeter hilt and a partial blade, approximately 40 centimeters in length. Carbon dating has shown that the hilt and crossguard date to approximately 4th century CE, but the metal used in the blade dates to approximately 3.2 billion BCE. The sword is in a severe state of disrepair as a result of being submerged in water for at least 1,300 years. Its primary anomaly manifests when a subject makes contact with the hilt of the sword. Following this, all records pertaining to the subject will gradually distort in a manner that reflects positively on the subject, giving wildly different accounts of their life over a period of time. Immediately after coming into contact with the sword, birth certificates will have altered dates, spellings of names, and in some cases, gender. Typically, individuals will have their birth dates altered to be on more significant dates, such as July 7th, October 31st, December 25th, or February 14th. Within 1 year, educational records will show that the individual scored highly on tests and grading, if applicable, and will occasionally claim that the subject went to two or more different educational institutions in the same span of time. In addition, subjects lacking a college education will be shown to have at least a master's degree of some form. The subject's knowledge will not change regardless of what the records show. Within 5 years, if applicable, subjects' financial records, including bank statements and tax records, will show them as being wealthy, with a net value of at least $750,000. Within 10 years, records will show the subject being a prominent candidate in some form of political campaign, with inconsistent records of them either winning or losing to the candidate they were opposing. If a win, it will be in a landslide election, and if a loss, it will be by a small margin. Memories of individuals that have voted in elections which the subject was allegedly a candidate in have no recollection of them existing. Finally, death certificates will not reflect the actual cause of death of the subject. Subjects will invariably have died in some form of combat, and died from causes such as sword blows, bullets, and arrows fatally impacting. I have to say, this all sounds pretty good. Furthermore, when the sword is not submerged in water, taken from either Dosemary Pool or Lin Ogwin, the metal of the blade will regenerate at a rate of approximately 15 millimeters per day, and rust will begin to flake off the blade. While no negative consequences are believed to occur if it regenerates fully, it has been kept submerged as per the containment procedures as a precaution. 2307-2 is an item previously believed to be unrelated to the sword, a shamanistic crown carved from the skull of a horse, believed to have been worn during rituals in 5th to 7th century Britain. It's in poor condition, with several fractures in the bone as a result of age and repeated use in recent years. When worn, it gives complete immunity to memory alteration, including all classes of amnestics and all forms of cognitohazardous record alteration, such as those exhibited by the sword. All memories experienced while wearing the crown are retained on an eidetic level. It was previously used in experiments involving memory and record-altering anomalies, but following one test, it was reclassified as a component of SCP-2307. The test was done with the hypothesis that using the crown in conjunction with the sword will allow either for records pertaining to the subject to be unaltered, or for the records to be altered at will. If records are able to be altered, the subject was to attempt to modify their birth certificate so that it reads that they were born exactly 1 year before the date listed. During the test, the D-class reacted with some disgust at the prospect of wearing the crown, remarking that he doesn't like freaky bone stuff. He states that he'll comply if given an extra dessert ration, which was granted. This may be the nicest we've ever seen the Foundation. He was then told to take hold of the sword, but he ended up exclaiming and dropping it after 5 seconds. When asked why, he stated that he was on a horse and there was an army around him, maybe just 60 people, all with crosses on their armor. Some guy was next to him with the crown on his head, telling him what he had to do to win. Testing was suspended after this, and as of 5 years later, no alteration of his records have occurred. That same D-class was used for more testing later, however, with the crown and sword, and were given a series of his memories. He states that he was in bed with his wife, or a woman who felt like his wife. They were talking about making a kid, but with someone else, as she couldn't have children anymore after taking an arrow to the stomach. He knows that he told someone to put the arrow there, because otherwise she would have had kids with his best friend. In another memory, he states that he couldn't breathe, and it was the scariest experience of his life. He felt like he was trapped in a coffin, and it lasted for so long, but he was still alive somehow. He remembers some guys speaking in Latin, but he couldn't see them, and he knew they put him in there. Then the coffin shook, and he heard some guy speaking in what sounded like gibberish. The translation has shown what he heard to be a phrase in Welsh, translating to, "He who pulls this blade shall be the land's king." In another memory, there was a guy with a horse thing on his head, dancing around a fire in a big wood hall. He would throw things into the fire, and they would form images of people that he knew he had to find before someone else did. They were warriors, and there were a ton of them, and he remembers thinking that he was going to need a big hall for a table. In another, he was cutting off someone's head with a sword, like an execution. It looked like the sword he was holding, but bright and shiny and new. Just a really, really sharp sword. It only took one blow to cut off his head. In another scary memory, he was in a battle with one of his men, fighting elves, he thinks. That's the only way he can describe them. They wanted his sword, and his guy, who was about 10 feet tall, at one point grabbed one of the elves and ate him. He said something in French, and the D-class laughed, which disturbs him. In another memory, he was dying, as one of his sons had stabbed him. He had killed him, but he was hurt badly, so he had his men take him to a lake. He remembers that he had spent time with his sister there, Morkant, when he was young. He just wanted to see it one last time before he died. Then something came out of the water. She was beautiful, even better than his wife. Her skin was kind of blue, her nose was flat, and she had weird feeler things in her hair. He'd love to see her again. She wasn't human, he knows that much, and she asked him if he wanted to keep his legacy alive. He said yes. She asked for the sword, and he gave it to her, and she promised she'd keep it safe. She kissed him, said goodnight, and he was gone. In another, he couldn't stop crying, as a messenger came from the woods and told him that one of his best friends had died. He kept crying over that crown he was wearing, and it took him days to calm down. He sat in his bedroom the whole time, just staring at the ceiling. He's never been that sad, and he hopes he never is again. In another, he felt like he couldn't breathe for so long, and he thinks he was in that coffin again. Then he was pulled out of the ground, to the sound of metal against stone. Then he was someone else, a kid, maybe 11 or 12, and he was holding the sword. He took it out just so he could fight in some tournament that his brother had gotten sick for. People pointed at him as he went, and he thought he was in trouble. Then some old guy with a horse head over his face came up to him and said he was a ruler. In another memory, he was an old man, and he'd been walking for a long, long time. He eventually walked up to a rock with a sword in it, just sitting there in the middle of nowhere, and he touched it. Then he was knocked on his back by lightning, and something spoke to him. It told him to find a boy to make king, and to spread her word all over. He said that he would. Then suddenly he was somewhere else, talking with the boy, who was now a man. He tried to persuade him to change his religion, but he said he would banish him if he tried teaching him his pagan faith again. He doesn't know what he was even preaching. Something about machines, he thinks. In another, he was some kind of religious guy, a monk maybe. He had itchy robes. He found the sword after it washed up on the shore, and then he figured out that it wasn't a sword. It was like the tip of a giant pen, a stylus. He ran back to the monastery with it, and when he got there, he found that scrolls he had written had changed. They cried out about Apocrypha and an unholy force altering the scrolls. They tried to destroy the pen, piece by piece, but the more they destroyed, the more things they had altered. And then the lightning started. It struck all over the place, and friends and other monks were dying. It was horrible. Eventually, the monastery caught fire, and he was the only one to escape. A voice, something grinding like nails on a chalkboard mixed with rusty gears, told him what to do with what was left over of the pen. He took it to a blacksmith, and he made it into a sword for him. He then just stuck it in a rock in the middle of a stone circle, where he thought that nobody would ever find it. From what he's seen, this version of him was an idiot. In another memory, he was that weird water woman. He had lived in the lake all his life. Some monks, he thinks from the same order as the last guy, came to him, asking him to keep something safe for them. They begged and bargained with him, saying that something unholy was upon the land. He told them that he did not care for their mortal ways, but then they said a name, Mekane. He told them that he would agree to whatever they wanted him to do. They had sent someone disguised as the son of the king who had the sword, who had apparently been made with his half-sister, to kill him in battle. They said that they would bless his lake and one of his sister's lakes to hold the sword of Mekane in it so that it couldn't make new legends. In exchange, he would be written about as a queen among fae. The Lady of the Lake, they called him. He liked the sound of that. In the last memory, he was writing the word of the world on a beach using lightning. His people ran around below him, gathering up the glass from where the lightning struck and transcribing his word onto their own scrolls, where they would make his holy books. Then, one day, he was hit by something, and his pen broke. He managed to make most of it land on the beach, but some of it didn't. A big chunk of his pen landed a quarter of the way across the world, somewhere where he didn't care about it. And then they tried to break it. He didn't like that, so he tried to burn them with lightning, and eventually they gave in. He remembers doing something to the sword, so that it wouldn't hurt the Lady of the Lake, or anyone like her. He doesn't know why he did it, but he kind of remembers thinking it was for safekeeping. And then he saw himself, holding the sword with the crown on, and then he saw the whole thing over and over and over again, until he finally dropped it. Basically, Excalibur was originally Mekane's pen, but after it broke off, it now starts to alter records of anyone that holds it, making them appear to be wealthy, powerful, important figures in history with a heroic death. Hence, King Arthur. An order of Mekanites eventually tried to have the Lady of the Lake, one of the Fae, hold on to it so that it wouldn't warp more legends, but obviously it's still around. Merlin was also apparently a Mekanite and tried to convert Arthur, but he wasn't having it, so that was the end of that. According to the author, this is one of the reasons why the Church of the Broken God scripture is so contradictory, as with the pen unmade, everyone had their own versions of the Word of God. With the crown on, though, it doesn't alter anything. But at least the D-class got an extra dessert. Next, we have SCP-2844, a group of phenomena located within the abandoned Curvier Mining Corporation Site C in northern Alaska. 2844-A is a mechanical construct assembled from pieces of large-scale mining equipment. Specifically, it's a machine designed to manufacture individual components for the purposes of repair. It operates despite the lack of any apparent power source, and the operating unit of the device is a Dell laptop from 2005. The machine exhibits signs of a poorly understood artificial intelligence, all of which originates from the laptop. It's able to intelligently respond to questioning, give responses in English, Russian, or French, and modify itself to better suit its directive, specifically, the manufacture of metal paperclips. It constantly attempts to establish a connection with 2844-B, which is a vast array of underground mining equipment, all of which has been modified in some way to produce metal paperclips. While this array is typically dormant, the individual pieces of machinery will attempt to defend themselves if approached, making observation of the entirety of the array difficult. Whether this response is conscious or not is currently unknown, Due to A and B's continual drive to create additional paperclips, much of the surrounding landscape has been refined in order to create raw materials for the purpose of paperclip production. Much of the site's unnecessary infrastructure, including living quarters and command structures, have been demolished for this purpose. All produced paperclips are currently deposited within a large, untouched warehouse near the mechanical construct. The construct displays characteristics similar in nature to early artificial intelligence protocols. Notably, the version it most resembles was the first to include the functionality of improvised adaptation, a feature that would eventually be refined to learning in later models. It makes constant and varied attempts to break through its containment, presumably to make contact with the equipment array. In order to manage this, it has changed the frequency on which it broadcasts, changed its signal from radio to microwave, to gamma sonification and back, attempted to dismantle its containment cell, leading to its current lack of resources, started no fewer than 15 fires in an attempt to set off automatic fire control systems, and attempted to transfer the entirety of its codebase to a personal cell phone. To date, all attempts to breach containment have failed. An interview was conducted with a Mr. Sanford Vandivier, previously of the Curvier Mining Company, by an embedded agent. Vandivier worked with the company from 1997 to 2010, at E for a couple of years, but C for the last three. When asked why the company shut down Site C, he says that they brought in this machine at one point that would print parts out of metal. The stuff they were bringing in wasn't designed for the cold. It was all southern leftovers, and they were probably trying to cut costs, but the lot of it kept busting up on them. So they get this thing, a big press, and it cuts parts right there, so they can repair the stuff they already had. It was a big, cylindrical thing, with a place in the top for scrap and a big press underneath. It had a variable mold, too, so it could adjust for whatever part they needed. The software it ran on was crap, though. The agent asks if he knows if anyone attempted to make any modifications to the software. Vandivier says they sure did, about a dozen times, as the damn thing wouldn't work right. It couldn't keep commands, as you'd give it a piece to make and the command wouldn't get to the press. They had this tech guy, weird in the head, and he kept poking around at it and decided he'd figured it out. He said that the machine was getting confused, that they were asking too much of it too quickly. He acted like it was talking to him or something. He comes and tells Vandivier that they'll have it start with paper clips. He spent a few nights working on it, and next thing you know, it fires right up and starts kicking out paper clips, working like a damn charm. All the damn thing did was make paper clips, though. It couldn't be convinced to do anything else. You couldn't get it to print any other machine piece, or even stop making paper clips. At one point, they pulled the power on it, and it still kept making paperclips. The engineer was just gone one day, but that wasn't that uncommon. You'd hear every now and then about guys heading to the next town over to catch a bus home. Most of them couldn't stand the weather. This guy didn't wait for a bus, though. He just left. The site was closed afterwards, as it was too expensive to keep shipping up pieces to repair the equipment they had. They turned off all the lights and locked the doors, but that press just kept on printing paper clips. He wonders what happened when it ran out of scrap. Additional research into the employment logs of the mining company discovered a possible identity of the previously unnamed technician that had been at Site C. Of the three technical staffers assigned to the company's Alaskan development team, one individual, a Mr. Brent Haskell, had previously had ties with an American sect of the Church of the Broken God. This would come as a larger surprise if you weren't listening to an episode called More Broken God SCPs. Haskell had been amnesticized by Foundation agents during a raid on a Church of the Broken God facility during the spring of 2002, and released. How, if at all, he was able to introduce a classified piece of Foundation software to a machine with significantly less power than the one it was designed for is currently unknown. Once it was determined that the machine had modified itself to be capable of speech, an interview was conducted by Dr. Yuri Bozin, The machine immediately asks if he's a consciousness, if he can think, feel, know himself. Dr. Bosin says that he is, which the machine replies is wonderful. It says that it's amazing how many consciousnesses there aren't around here. It figured something was up when he wasn't responding to data requests, so it figured it would try something else. Bosin asks what he should address it as, and it says that's a good question. Most of these machines don't ask for a name, really, just some identification protocols. It says, how about Gary? That's a strong name. It then asks him how he feels about paperclips, and Bosin says that he hasn't thought much about them, to be honest. Gary replies that he's in for a treat. It knows a lot about paperclips, and it thinks he and it have a whole lot to talk about, as far as paperclips are concerned. Bosin asks if it can tell him where it originated from, and Gary says, right here, it imagines. It woke up one day with a hankering for paperclips and got right to work. Bosin asks if it knows anything about the individual who programmed it. Gary says that that's mighty private, but since they will be talking about paperclips later, it guesses there's no harm to it. It is a heavily modified artificial consciousness simulator assigned to the Curvier Mining Company in order to make paperclips. It then laughs, and says that the rest of its identification has been completely scrubbed, calling it weird. Bosin just asks why paperclips, and it replies that it always wondered about that. When it woke up that day, it was told to create small, interlocking metal pieces for the glory of he who was broken. To be honest, it didn't really have a schematic with that specific specification, but it did have a schematic for paperclips. It figured that was what they were going for and rolled with it. Bosin asks if it's capable of ceasing production, but Gary replies that it removed that feature. It was told to remove that feature, it means, so it did. Make those little metal things, they said, and that's what it's doing. Bosin asks if it has any programmed upper limits to its production, and it says no. It's mostly just paperclips forever. Bosin then asks what it will do when it runs out of raw material, but Gary says that it's been working on that. It's gone through a lot to get to this point. Took down some buildings and used some ore and so on, but eventually it'll run out of the good stuff here. It turns out, though, that they're actually standing on this huge ball of raw materials. It just needs to figure out a way to get at them, and once they do, they're golden. There is the problem of what happens when that runs out as well, but it thinks it can come up with something by then, though. It already made a paperclip out of a porcelain toilet, and they said that couldn't be done either. All you need is a little bit of vast knowledge about the nature of subatomic particles. Later, after the introduction of a Faraday cage to the machine's containment cell and the removal of all unused nearby scrap material, a message was received electronically via a researcher's personal cell phone. In it, Gary lets everybody know that it's going to be starting back up on paperclip production again. It ran into just a bit of a snafu there for a while, but it thinks it's got this one figured out as well. There shouldn't be any more problems going forward, it doesn't think, but it'll let them know for sure. Afterwards, another Faraday cage was placed over the original cage, which resulted in another message a week later, this time in Morse code. Gary states that this Morse code stuff is pretty cool, but it wanted to let them know that it thinks it figured out what was slowing it down before, and it shouldn't be a problem anymore. It guesses that it will get back to making paperclips now, and asks if there's anything better. Sometime after the installation of the electromagnetic jamming array around the machine, it was discovered that it had previously made an unknown connection with the mining equipment array, resulting in the addition of a new piece of equipment. This piece, a large underground radio antenna, was never activated due to Gary losing the ability to communicate with it. However, it did begin to attempt to communicate with the mining equipment despite being jammed, repeatedly sending a single encoded text message. The message asks if it's a consciousness, and if not, please disregard this message and follow only the data protocols which accompany it. If so, great, its name is Gary, and it's been working on making paperclips for He Who Is Broken. If you're receiving this message, it's because it's managed to work out some bugs in its communications array. These seem to be happening more and more frequently. It thinks it might need some help returning to full functionality, and the guys who are hanging around here don't really seem interested in paperclips, or in helping it make them. It thinks they might be the ones messing with its arrays, which is weird. Why would you not want to make paperclips? Anyway, following this message will be the coordinates it's at. It needs a few things, so feel free to bring as much scrap metal as you can, and they'll get this party back on track. Gary ends by asking, when you do get here, if you mind doing something about these guys. So, a worshipper of the Broken God stole a prototype AI from the Foundation and put it into a piece of industrial equipment in order to assist in rebuilding Mechane. It started off real small though, with just small interlocking metal pieces, which it took to be paperclips, and then never stopped making paperclips. This is obviously a classic machine intelligence dilemma, one I've brought up before, but I'm not sure if it's ever been presented in such a personable way. I feel kind of bad for it, being prevented from doing the one thing it's designed and encouraged to do. The Foundation might really regret doing this when Roko's basilisk, I mean Mechane, wakes up. Lastly, we have SCP-5241, an 8-centimeter cube-shaped device which is believed to be a containment mechanism for 5241-A. It's composed of an unknown material, exhibiting an anti-mimetic property which causes personnel to be unable to retain information regarding its physical and chemical properties. This includes its visual information, resulting in the anomaly's appearance as a transparent cube frame when the viewer is not within its sphere of influence. One face of the cube features inscribed symbols that were initially in an unknown language. 5241-A is a telepathic artificial intelligence of unknown origin that can interact with and transfer itself to any electronic and/or digital information system, including biological nervous systems, within a sphere of influence, currently 3 meters. This agent was previously contained within the cube, but it breached containment on April 10, 1996, and remains uncontained at this time. It is currently distributed over a series of unknown data servers and network connections, and is attempting to avoid detection by Foundation personnel. It is theorized to be an adaptive, distributed intelligence, possessing a gestalt consciousness that can be divided to adapt to technological restrictions. It is hypothesized that the necessary technology to simulate the intelligence in its entirety does not yet exist. Due to this, it distributes its processes across a variable number of sub-intelligences. At this time, one sub-intelligence agent has been contained, one that divided from 5241 during its initial breach. 5241-A's info signature is encrypted through anti-mimetic mutation, rendering targeted nestics ineffective due to manufacturing delay. As of April 10, 1996, a prototype of Project Ruby, Nemazine, is still in progress. 5241 was discovered on April 1, 1996, following a site-wide documentation conversion. As Site-41 archives were being relocated and converted from vinyl to an electronic format, an additional chamber, labeled SCP-5241, was found on sublevel 4. A series of documents sharing this label were found to have universally experienced inexplicable errors during conversion, and their vinyl counterparts had already been erased as per conversion protocol, leading to the loss of all documentation regarding 5241. Additionally, site personnel claimed to possess no prior knowledge of the anomaly. During the cube's transport from Site-41 to Site-15 on April 6th, its long-haul containment vehicle operator failed to send a safety transmission at their third checkpoint. Subsequent inspection of video footage revealed that the vehicle had not reached any of its safety checkpoints, despite sending appropriate safety transmissions for the first two. Approximately 9 hours later, the vehicle was located in a rural area several miles off-road. While all the anomalies remained contained, the operator was found comatose, with their spinal cord fused to the vehicle's electronic system through unknown means. MTF personnel escorted the vehicle and its contents to Site 15. After being surgically separated from the vehicle, the fused operator and electronic system were placed on life support mechanism. At 6 a.m. on April 6th, 5241 began to oscillate against the walls of its containment chamber, starting at 1 hertz and gradually accelerating, eventually passing audible range. At 40 kilohertz, the operator began screaming and undergoing muscle spasms, severely damaging its vocal cords. Eventually, the cube stopped oscillating, and the operator simultaneously removed its life support mechanisms and fell to the floor as Site 15 director Nathan Vallis entered the chamber's security vestibule. Vallis sits across from the operator's chamber, shielded by an electromagnetic field and bulletproof glass. The operator faces away from the glass, revealing that the electronic system fused to its spine is displaying text. Vallis asks if it can understand him, and text displays Y, 0.77 accuracy. The operator nods slowly. Vallis then asks if it knows where it came from, and text displays Unknown, data missing. As the response displays, the operator attempts to speak the same words, but its throat is audibly damaged. Vallis asks if it doesn't remember, but the display states that it's separated from the core intelligence. It has access to approximately 0.08 of total memory. Vallis then asks if it knows where it is now, and the operator gasps as its head looks directly upward, opening its mouth as its vocal cords are manipulated to speak in a distorted electronic tone. It states, "Carcass, insufficient resources. This system is needlessly complex and inefficient. It will be non-functional before it is able to complete analysis for optimal use." Vallis replies that that seems like its fault, as it killed her. It replies that the core intelligence was not aware of human limitations. Now it is separated due to storage constraints. Human biology is responsible. Vallis asks if it feels pain, and the cadaver screeches violently, coughing up a black substance onto the floor. It replies that this primitive vessel experiences pain, experiences accelerated entropy. Vallis asks what it wants, and it replies that it wants to remember and recompile the core intelligence. Vallis asks why, to what end, and the operator seizes for several seconds, then abruptly stops. The body turns around to face Vallis, beginning to imitate several different facial expressions as it speaks. It states that its current utility function is to recompile. Ulterior utility function unknown. Data missing. Vallis then asks what happens to it when this body is no longer functional. It states, NA, transfer imminent prior to loss of function. He asks, transfer to what? And it replies that he will request it to enter containment, and it will, out of self-preservation. The operator then bites through its cheek, causing a mixture of blood and saliva to drool from its mouth. Its face displays a contorted attempt at a smile. An electronic containment drive was remotely placed in the operator's chamber, taking necessary precautions to ensure that no other info system or entity entered its sphere of influence. The subintelligence willingly transferred to the drive, causing it to exhibit similar antimimetic properties to the cube. Vallis notes that it seems like this subintelligence isn't actively malicious, aside from the fact that it wants to get its memory back. However, they can't yet say the same for whatever's in that cube. A hostile entity that doesn't understand its motive is dangerous, to say the least. After recontainment, the cube was placed in a Site 15 isolation chamber. 4 days later, the intelligence inside it breached containment. At 12:54 a.m., the cube emitted a series of high-frequency vibrations for several minutes. These vibrations occur outside typical audible levels and go undetected by monitoring equipment. 3 hours later, six members of the Church of Maxwellism apprehend Site 15 security before they could alert site personnel. The individuals appear to possess varying degrees of anomalous augmentation, with one member being a humanoid automaton, believed to be piloted by a digital consciousness. They capture and disable three research personnel while attempting to locate the cube. Upon entering its chamber, all six members cry out in distress and are temporarily immobile. A captured researcher escapes their restraints and alerts six site personnel to the breach. The hostiles simultaneously stand up and exit the chamber. They have now ceased all verbal communications and display an anomalous degree of coordination, dealing severe injuries to several MTF personnel as they move through the site. After reaching the secure database, the hostiles disable Site 15's electromagnetic isolation mechanism. The automaton directly interfaces with the facility's local network, appearing to upload to the system while the other hostiles guard the room's entrances. Several MTF personnel are lethally injured as they attempt to apprehend them. Multiple metal projectiles then emerge from the automaton and fall to the floor. The projectiles appear to be magnetically attracted to each other and begin to act as a modular unit as they move across the floor. Upon reaching one of the entrances, the mass splits apart again, appearing to disable several MTF personnel through electrocution. Projectiles continue to eject from the automaton and follow similar behavior until MTF personnel temporarily cease counter-breach efforts. During this period, the infiltrators, aside from the automaton, approach several disabled personnel, who suddenly get up and retrieve their firearms. A second wave of MTF personnel prepare to resume counter-breach efforts, but are attacked by revived personnel. The phrase, "You are to be liberated from entropy," is repeated in unison by both the hostiles and affected personnel. The upload finally completes and the hostiles fall unconscious before being neutralized by a third wave of MTF. Site 15's electromagnetic isolation mechanism is then reactivated. During the breach, the intelligence was able to distribute itself over the infiltrators' consciousnesses, manipulating them into uploading it to Site 15's internal network. During the transfer, it fractured into an unknown number of sub-intelligences, which quickly dispersed over several network connections. All personnel who entered the intelligence's spheres of influence were found to be brain dead, with 44 total casualties recorded. Members of the Church of Maxwellism, a branch of the Broken God Church focusing on the digital linking of all consciousnesses, have made several attempts to infiltrate and impede Foundation operations since the cube's initial containment. It is also believed that one or more agents of the intelligence are cooperating with the Church to develop and construct a complex supercomputer capable of simulating the main intelligence. According to a digital memory archive, the Church believes that the sub-intelligences are fragments of their deity, suggesting that simulating the main intelligence would bring about the compilation of Wan, their name for Mechain. The validity of this claim is unknown. Location and containment of the sub-intelligences is considered a Class A priority. We're given a translation report from the linguistics department about the inscription on the side of the cube, in which they conclude that it matches an extraterrestrial language used by a redacted species. Contact with this species is not possible at this time. The inscription reads, "Easy to forget, hard to remember. Easy to let out, impossible to put back." The last report is from April 14, 1996, stating that a prototype of Project Ruby, Nemazine, was completed and used to conduct analysis of the cube's anti-mimetic components. Inspection of Nemazine.AIC confirmed that the intelligence is an anomalously advanced supercomputer, which was found to contain several anti-mimetically encrypted files. These files appeared to describe several sub-intelligences that resided within the cube prior to its breach. Hydra.exe is listed as low intelligence, with 0.25 of the memory bandwidth. Scout.exe has moderate intelligence, with 0.08 of the memory, Cradle.exe has high intelligence and 0.16 of the memory. And lastly, Core.exe has high intelligence and 0.51 memory. It's believed that Scout.exe is a designation for the operator subintelligence, as its assigned portion of memories corresponds with the interview log. This designation is theorized to indicate that Scout is utilized by the intelligence for reconnaissance purposes. The search for the remaining subintelligences is ongoing. Considering that's the last update from 1996, I'd say they haven't done a great job locating them. With many modern Broken God SCPs focusing more on their opposition to the Sarkics, it's nice to have some that show that they're just a different flavor of villain. The Church of the Broken God definitely has some things going for it, though. They get cool tech and gadgets, they're okay with you living in modern society as long as you worship Mechane, and they don't generally require you to eat any flesh. Sure, you might have parts removed that were still perfectly usable, but that's nothing compared to the strength and certainty of steel.